This is Common Sense Radio. Straightforward and no excuses.
All right. Come on now.
This is the Steve Gruber Show.
Call me crazy.
Ooh, yeah.
What I said was perfectly right and spot on accurate.
Boy's got a mouth like a cannon, always shooting it all.
Stop. Yeah, stop. I mean, you're way off script.
Got it in me. Gonna quit until it all comes out.
Hey, boy.
Yeah, you know, it's not cynical, it's common sense.
Pay attention to me when I'm talking to you.
I'm gonna rock the nation. Rock the nation.
Genuine, accountable, and raw. Here is Steve Gruber.
Six after on this Thursday, if you've been out shopping for the Christmas season, and you've looked around and said, gosh, it just feels like there's more people around. There are two reasons. Number one, shopping is up this year, which is good news for the economy. And there are also more Michigan residents. That can be problematic for you when you're trying to shop. Yeah, there are more people around. Michigan's population increased for the fifth straight year in 2016. The fifth year we're up. Data released this week estimated the state gained just about 11,000 people, 0.1%. To just shy of 10 million. That was as of July. Now the winter's here, that population may have decreased a wee bit. Michigan remains the 10th most populous state. North Carolina, however, hopped us into 9th place. Utah, the fastest growing, with its population increasing 2% in 2016 to over 3 million people. Utah broke 3 million. Growing everywhere, but anyhow, I just thought it'd be interesting. You know, Michigan lost a seat after the 2000 census in Congress. And apparently, if this continues, Michigan will lose another congressional seat after the next comprehensive national census in 2020. That, according to the University of Michigan Population Studies Center and their apportionment tool. Pretty soon, it'll just be all the delegates and all members of Congress, except for one from each state, will be in California. And then the Democrats will have exactly what they want. Isn't it interesting, by the way? Democrats still bemoaning the Electoral College and how awful it is. And, you know, they believe in the popular vote. Well, they do, unless it's something like, say, gay marriage, where states like California voted against gay marriage. The popular vote voted against it. And then they don't like the popular vote, and they go to the courts. Isn't it interesting that the Democrats and the left love the Constitution, they'll tell you time and again, until you have something like the Electoral College outlined in the Constitution, and they go bananas and hate it, about as much as they hate the Second Amendment, but maybe not quite that much. The Constitution is their friend until they decide it's just an antiquated document that, you know, it's 250 years old and doesn't mean anything. It's all so much bunk. Don't you think? Anyhow, the search still continues for the Tunisian man believed to be one of the suspects in the slaughter at the Christmas carnival in Berlin. And Donald Trump asked about the terror attack in Germany. And whether it'll have any effect on his plans to ban some Muslims from coming into the country, he said, the market in Berlin that was attacked was an attack against humanity, and it's got to be stopped. Donald Trump, it's clip 7 here today. Clip 7. Donald Trump, go.
Hey, you know my plans all along. I've been proven to be right 100% correct. What's happening is disgraceful. An attack on humanity. That's what it is. It's an attack on humanity.
It shall be stopped. An attack on humanity, he was saying. A little hard to hear a little bit, but an attack on humanity. Meanwhile, strategic analyst Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Peters, who you see often on Fox News if you frequent that station, talked about what countries have filled power vacuums in the Middle East and why the United States is now on the outside looking in. And this is all part of that bigger picture of refugees and terrorism and instability in the Middle East. Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Peters, it's clip 10. Go.
Well, there's no longer a power vacuum because Russia and Iran have filled it, and Turkey have filled it. What we have just seen in Moscow with the issue of the Moscow Declaration, we saw three powers, three regional powers, Iran, Turkey, and Russia, divide up the upper Middle East, the northern Middle East, into spheres of influence. Turkey gets a free hand against the Kurds, and the ethnic Turks in Syria we protected in the north in an enclave. Russia gets more bases, greater influence. Iran gets Iraq. And there's nothing we can do about it. The 8 years of the Obama presidency has seen this unprecedented, phenomenal collapse of American power. 8 years ago, Iraq was convalescing. The Middle East was relatively peaceful. Our military was respected and feared. And now Iranians can grab our sailors. We're excluded from really this conference in Moscow that has decided the future of the Middle East and excluding us. We're now out.
On the outside looking in, excluded from the conference altogether. On another front, but part of the same conversation, as Donald Trump prepares to take the oath of office and become the 45th president of the United States, a major showdown now looms between his administration and cities across the country over one of those hallmark campaign issues, which is illegal immigration. So you've got refugees and you've got illegals coming over the border right now at an unprecedented rate. Right now at the southern border, agents are on pace to apprehend nearly 600,000 illegals. The highest number in 8 years. Now, why do you think that is? Coming largely from Central America, far outpacing any of those from Mexico. And they're mobilizing quite simply because they don't know what's going to happen after the 20th of January. They figure they better get there now. Declare themselves unaccompanied minors, claim that they have family in the United States, do whatever it takes under Barack Obama's loose admission rules before they get tightened up dramatically. Many illegal immigrants certainly motivated to make the trek because the request for asylum claiming credible fear of persecution should they return home may or may not stand under the next president. But another driver is the knowledge that certain major cities in America are sanctuary cities where there is some protection afforded to these folks from deportation. Those same cities are now gearing up to fight on their illegal immigrant residents' behalf against the incoming president. For example, Mayor Eric Garcetti of Los Angeles announcing the creation of the LA Justice Fund, a multi-million-dollar fund to provide legal assistance to illegal aliens. The reason it was important for us to act is we will have a change in government next month, he said. We expect there could be actions right away. In announcing the fund, Garcetti vowed to fight for the good and law-abiding immigrants of Los Angeles. Law-abiding. They broke the law to come here, but he calls them law-abiding. The oxymoron is stunning, to say the least. We'll keep a close eye on it, my friends, because it's not going to get any easier. 14 after on a Thursday here on the Steve Gruber Show.
Delivering Michigan common sense with a big dose of truth and honesty. I was born in a
class by hurricane. Michigan Governor Rick Snyder has signed two bills updating Michigan's eight-year-old energy law, the result of a late compromise between major utilities and customers in the state's deregulated electric choice market, which is pretty small, really. The legislation signed yesterday includes more requirements for utilities and alternative energy suppliers that serve Michigan's 10% choice market to plan for longer-term electricity needs and show state regulators they have enough power, owned or under contract, to meet their customers' demands. Utilities, including DTE, say planning over a longer period of time will give them more certainty about electricity needs as they plan to build new power plants. Stephen Transeth is here with me today. Steve is a principal partner at the Lansing law firm Transeth & Associates, which specializes in energy and utility law. Stephen, welcome back to the program.
Nice to talk to you again.
Well, glad to have you here. Break this bill down for us. Give us the bullet points of this bill and what it means to folks real quickly.
Well, first of all, it was quite an event yesterday. I had the distinct pleasure of actually having to be there. It was one of those experiences where, having been involved in this for over 30 years, it's that rare opportunity where everybody came together at the end. Everybody got a little bit of what they needed and came away with a little bit of what they didn't have, and so it's a perfect compromise. So it was a bipartisan, both out of the Senate and the House, in which both sides finally came to an agreement. The bill was, these bills were started about 2 years ago, actually more than that, at the previous session, but they were introduced right at the beginning of the session 2 years ago, went through lengthy hearings for those 2 years, and finally came together here at the last hour, the 11th hour and the 59th minute. Finally, a compromise was struck in which those who... It involves a great deal, obviously, like over 200 pages.
Let me hold up, because I want to jump on something you said here, Steve. You said it's the perfect compromise, and yet critics say that, once again, competition was pushed to the side by what they refer to as monopolies, those being the bigger established power companies and energy companies in the state. And so open competition, if you will remain at 10%. And they say that's just not good for Michigan. I mean, that's what the critics say. So I give you a chance to say why you don't feel that way.
Obviously, there's going to be some dissenters, but the vast majority of those, including many of the companies who participate in choice and who are the largest and loudest vocal opposition to this bill, agreed with the final outcome. The problem with the bill that was... It was never, the 10% was never at issue, and it's important that that 10% remains there to ensure that the utilities have a base upon which to build a new generation. Everybody was under the agreement that new generations had to be built at some point as we go forward. These bills really kind of dealt with what is that generation going to look like, who's going to build it, and how are we going to pay for it. Those on choice, the main debate about the choice issue was, as we look at that, right now there's no obligation on those on choice to pay for any future generation costs. And they were afraid that in these bills, up until the end, that the what they call a capacity charge, which is basically that generation cost, was going to discriminate against them and unfairly hurt their ability to be competitive going forward. So the compromise basically made sure that whatever those costs were, that they were going to be non-discriminatory, that they were going to be applied to all customers in the same fashion, regardless if they were on choice or not choice, and make sure that the commission is looking at that and making sure that that is the way we want to go. There's the ability to other
markets. I want to jump in here because there's something else. Sure. The nagging question, and this may or may not be in your wheelhouse as far as expertise goes, but just across the border to the north, Ontario has seen its rate increases for electricity go up 315% in the last 3 years. 315%. And most people up there that study this and are watching this believe that rate increases could be totaled at 500% in the next couple of years. So if their electric bill was $100, it's now $500 in Ontario because they eliminated all coal-fired power plants. And you know Michigan relies about 60% of our electricity comes from coal-fired power plants currently. We're closing a whole number of plants. And how does Michigan avoid these massive increases like we've seen in Ontario, Canada?
Great question, and it is one that we looked at and were very careful in crafting this legislation. Much of the reason why this legislation was necessary is we wanted to avoid exactly that. There's no question. These plants, by the way, many of them here in Michigan, 10 of them closed, 15 or more scheduled to close by 2025, are more due to age and cost factor to try to keep them to meet current standards than it is anything that's coming out
of
Washington.
Well, you hit the right thing. It's current standards. It's about the EPA. It's not about whether these plants produce enough electricity or are efficient. It's about meeting current standards. We only got about a minute left, but please continue.
Okay. So the whole purpose was to make sure that what we do going forward is that it's going to be reliable. When we go into our homes and businesses, we're going to flip that switch and the lights are going to come on. And secondly, a key component, double pong, was that that's going to remain affordable for everybody, both businesses and residents.
All right, so I'll ask you, you've got 30 seconds. I know it's a tough question, but in 30 seconds, how do we not see 500% rate increases like they're going to experience in Ontario when we close all of these plants?
The legislation requires a careful planning. It's called an IRP, an integrated resource planning, that looks out over, this is a total picture, not a by utility, but that we're going to make a specific plan to make sure that Michigan's needs are met at the same time that's being met in an affordable way. I assure you, Steve, we're not going to see those kind of rates here rise here in Michigan.
Well, and that's what people want to know for starters. The rest of the conversation will continue to break down over the next few days, weeks, and months. But, Steve, I greatly appreciate your time, and thank you for stopping in again.
Great talking to you, too, Steve.
Stephen Transith, partner of the Lansing law firm Transith & Associates. Energy utility law is his area of expertise. The biggest concern is that we follow suit with Ontario. Clearly, I don't want to pay 300% more. I don't want to pay, 35% more, to be honest with you. It's 25 after on this Thursday. Back in a moment.
Getting your day started with news from around the state and around the world. Common Sense Radio. This is the Steve Gruber Show.
It's 33 after the hour, and I'd call that a bargain. The Steve Gruber Show, 888-900-9966, 888-900-9966. My next guest, Christopher Harris, is the executive director of Unhyphenated America. You can find it at unhyphenatedamerica.org and Facebook as well. Well, what about this? $679 million in U.S. funds is what it costs to build a 648-megawatt solar power plant in India, making it the largest in the world now. That country feeling a sense of urgency, it seems, because of several of its industrial hubs reaching air pollution records. But is it a sensible way to go? Christopher Harris here with me again. Christopher, welcome back to the program.
Hi, good morning, Steve.
That's a whole lot of money. Whole lot of money. Is the return on investment worth it?
It's the big whopping answer is no. it's just not. Not for an emerging country like India. You don't see the difference between a civilized society and an uncivilized society typically is like the use of tools, right? When you look at the caveman, you see that their use of tools was minimal, right? Just they use stone, right? Instead of, we have sophisticated machinery, they use stones and sticks. But the thing that separates a first world country, if you will, from a third world country is power, electricity. In India, with a population of over 1.3 million people, it's the second most populous country in the nation, but they still have the same number of people that we have in the United States. They have that number of people in their nation who don't have access to electricity. And so the problem is, the reason I bring this up is that the greenie weenies, the tree huggers, they're causing problems all over the world. Just like they're causing problems here in the United States, they're causing problems in India the same way. And they're pushing the same ridiculous thing of trying to do, like Solyndra, right, solar power. Well, solar power is great. I love the sun like everyone else, Steve, but, it doesn't shine all the time. At least it doesn't. Well, the sun's always shining, right? But it's only you have sun
right,
up,
right.
The sun down.
But here's my question. India. If you've not seen the pictures, go look. It's shocking how filthy much of that nation is, whether it's garbage on the ground or the slums or the air pollution. I mean, what is the country to do? I mean, it's filthy, and if they want to clean up what's coming out of their smokestacks, so they turn to solar power, what's a better alternative for them?
Oh, there are plenty of alternatives. They could have built, with that money, they could have built a natural gas plant that would have produced more consistent energy, which, hey, one of the things that could have happened, they could have traded natural gas or bought natural gas from the United States. We've got tons of it. There's better clean coal technology that, I mean, of course, now we know the United States is like the Saudi Arabia of coal and even clean coal, which I know the left tries to act like clean coal does not exist, but there's definitely technology that makes the use of burning coal a lot cleaner. You know, what you do have is that the left is always trying to find ways to keep people under control. And they would actually, if they really cared about the environment, having access to more power would allow them to clean up. I mean, you know, you'd be able to use tools to help clean up your environment. But, I mean, you know, you have 1.3 billion, as I mentioned before, 1.3 billion people in this nation who are all producing waste. And, you know, like the 300 million of them alone, you know, they produce waste. What do you think they're producing? They're producing waste. You know, they're using up resources, but they're not using them efficiently and effectively. And that's the problem that I always have with the left. They do the same thing in India as they do here. You know, you have President Obama. He went to Africa and he tried to talk to them about the fact that they shouldn't be using things like where they're trying to bring electricity and air conditioning. It's like, hey, have you ever visited West Africa? It's hot. It's pretty much always hot.
Yes, I visited West Africa on a couple of occasions. Yeah, it's hot. Even in the cold weather, it's hot. But we need long-term, I mean, 1.3 billion people, producing waste, as you say. I mean, India has trouble taking care and cleaning up its own backyard as it is, fair to say. So, is solar panels, are they starting in the wrong place to clean up the problem? All this money spent on a solar plant that creates 648 megawatts, which really isn't very big by today's standards, right?
No, definitely. It's not very big at all. Once again, the problem is the left causes problems, whether they're here in the United States or in India. But in this case, the sad thing, what caught my interest, is that, you know, they're able to push their agenda a lot easier on these third world countries and causing someone, just like somebody got rich with Solyndra, right? I mean, Solyndra and all these other green energy plans that the Obama administration helped to push, that they turned around and put that money back into the Obama administration. We know about how that circular thing happened. You know, Obama gives subsidies to them, and they turn around and contribute to the Obama campaign. No doubt that same thing happened over in India. And, you know, it was a waste of money, $679 million, to create this huge solar energy plant that's not even going to put a dent in their energy needs. And this is one of the things that we just try to educate people, not just about what's going on here in the United States, but to understand the greater problem of what happens when you allow leftist-minded people to create public policy.
Well, there you go. So here's my quick question, shifting gears just slightly, but Barack Obama has now put off limits much of the Arctic waters controlled by the United States, the North Atlantic also put off limits by Barack Obama, some say permanently, but the incoming president-elect Donald Trump doesn't see it that way, neither does his team. How do you think this plays out? Donald Trump obviously going to be an energy president, so he says to continue the American energy renaissance. What do you think of it? We got about a minute left.
Well, the long story short is I would like to encourage President-elect Trump to take everything that Obama did and exit out. I mean, that would be, you know, one of the best things he could do for this country is to just undo like 99.9% of the things that President Obama has done. They've all been detrimental to this country. That his executive orders should all be done. We have a Congress that should be very compliant. That energy is the number one thing. I mean, this economy should be nearly double what it is. So the productivity of America could double. Here's what I would ask President-elect Trump to do. Slash taxes. I'm going to go back to the old Republican conservative playbook. Slash taxes,
right,
and slash regulation.
That'd be a good place to start, wouldn't you think? Christopher, I have to run, my friend. Merry Christmas to you and your family.
Hey, Merry Christmas, Steve. Always good to talk to you.
Christopher Harris, Executive Director of Unhyphenated America. Find it at unhyphenatedamerica.org. Quick break and then back on the Steve Gruber Show.
Covering Michigan and the world from his bunker below the bridge. Here is Steve Gruber.
After on this Thursday. A lot of activity in the lame duck session. We've been talking about the energy bills signed, but more notable of the last few days, I think, the work by Attorney General Bill Schuette now. Bill Schuette also being, I think, the way I understand this, being told that he had no authority to limit state agencies' access to the Flint health data and so forth. Here to sort it all out for us and what's going on, the latest chapter in the Flint saga, Chad Livengood from the Detroit News. Chad, welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Steve.
So let's start with this. Is Governor Rick Snyder going to be charged in this case by Attorney General Bill Schuette?
Well, he doesn't. I think he will be. And yesterday I asked him directly, are you concerned that you will? And he said he has no reason to be concerned. He didn't see what he would be charged over. That was his response.
I'm not sure Mr. Early thought he was going to be charged either, though. I mean, the emergency manager charged 13 people now. And I guess I go by your gut as a reporter. I mean, I'm feeling like Attorney General Bill Schuette might just do this if it leads her. I mean, right now he's walked all the way to Lansing with this investigation. He's standing at the doorstep of the governor, the way I see it, and so do some other folks. I mean, is it possible or is it likely? I mean, it's possible, I suppose. Do you think it's likely? I guess.
Well, anything's possible. I'm kind of, it's 2016, Steve. I'm kind of out of the predicting business.
Fair point.
I don't know where to lead, but I mean, the general some of the charges against Darna Early and Jerry Ambrose, the two emergency managers in Flint, are very specifically trying to paint a picture that they committed conspiracy by going around some of the city's debt limits and trying to get money borrowed authorization from state government to then turn around and they claimed they were going to use it for fixing a sludge facility from the water treatment plant, and they in turn used the money allegedly for building the new pipeline. That was the reason why Flint went, dropped the Detroit River water or Detroit water system and went into this new pipeline and temporarily used the Flint River as its drinking source. And that's what a big part of the Attorney General's case is revolves around. But then the other charges that he has leveled against the emergency managers and pretty much everybody else is that they willfully were in neglect of duty of their office, and that's a tough one to prove in court, I'm told, to prove that they willfully did this, but it's a charge that everyone has been leveled, and it seems possible that if you could throw that against the emergency managers, you probably could throw it against the chief of staff and top aides, the governor, and maybe even the big guy himself.
Well, exactly, because here's my, I don't know, just as an observer standing here on the street corner watching it all go by, if they get to the emergency managers, which he has, Bill Schuette has, well, then the buck stops and the governor's does. He's the guy that put these people in charge. He's the guy that, moved this along and ended up with this failed situation. So, to me, it's not much of a stretch to say, well, governor, you are culpable because of this or that, and there's got to be some, idea that maybe politics is in here somewhere.
That is certainly being discussed in many Republican and Democratic circles in Lansing right now. The Attorney General, Bill Schuette, has not been shy in his pretty clear desire to be governor. He's not declared anything yet, but he's raising money. At the same time, his most likely closest rival is the lieutenant governor of Michigan, Brian Kelly. So there is certainly a political aspect here. I mean, he denies it. The Attorney General does, because they're just following the facts. But the pace of the investigation, these charges, there's a question out here that it hasn't been answered. And why did it take so long to file these charges against this emergency manager and these two utility workers or two utility administrators in Flint, when they already charged another utility administrator in Flint way back in April? So the pace of this investigation has led to people to raise questions about whether the Attorney General is slow walking it for purposes of getting ramping up a campaign for governor in the new year.
Yeah, I'm not going to level the allegation, but it certainly makes people ask a lot of questions. As you pointed out, Republicans and Democrats alike are like, what's going on here? What's really happening, and how long is this going to take? So what's the next step?
Well, I mean, the other thing is, let's not forget here, Steve, you're still innocent until proven guilty. So just charging someone, whether it is emergency manager or a low-level bureaucrat at the Department of Environmental Quality, doesn't mean you're going to actually convict them and send them to jail. That's really the next test here as these cases go into the court system this winter and spring, is to see whether these charges will ever stick. For the governor yesterday, he responded to me and also other reporters, basically, questioning out loud how he could be charged. And he didn't want to say directly, but we asked him. He didn't dispute the notion that the Attorney General is effectively trying to criminalize decision making and bad decision making by career state workers and by these appointees of the governor.
Chad, good information. We have to leave it there. Chad Livengood from the Detroit News. It's a fascinating case. It has been for some time, and we'll keep you on speed dial. Merry Christmas, my friend.
Merry Christmas to you, Steve.
There you have it. Chad Livengood from the Detroit News. Find out more at DetroitNews.com. You're listening to The Steve Gruber Show.